Today I'm going to be talking about some work that based on the algorithm I originally sketched in this archive paper. If you try and deduce what the algorithm is supposed to be doing based on that archive paper, the odds are you'll walk away with virtually no idea of what the algorithm is supposed to be doing. So I went and dragged a few people into this project with me to actually analyze the behavior of the algorithm and kind of flesh it out some, give some actual runtime down and stuff like that. So I included Brad Lackey, Kiana Wan, and Aiki Liu. And both Kiana and Aiki were here, at least until very recently, and Brad's at UMD. All right, so a bit of background. Adiabatic optimization, for those of you who are potentially unfamiliar with it, we have two Hamiltonians, an initial Hamiltonian and a final Hamiltonian. Final Hamiltonian is going to encode some problem, some computational problem that's potentially hard that we want to find the optimum for. So in this case, we're going to be looking for the smallest value. H-naught is just some known driving Hamiltonian. So our experimentalist went into his lab, built this, and we're going to use it. And then H1 is maybe some transverse field or something. And we're going to use an interpolation. Usually they appear something like this, some sort of linear interpolation between the two Hamiltonians, right? And the adiabatic theorem tells us that if we go slowly enough in physical time, not interpolation time, well, then we're going to get some sort of, we're going to always remain close to our ground state. So if we prepare a state initially close to our ground state, we'll end up in a state initially close to its ground state. And since the optimization problem, we're looking for its minimum, the ground state's going to give us that information. But the adiabatic theorem typically gives us scaling like 1 over gap squared or 1 over gap cubed, depending upon which version of the adiabatic theorem you're citing. I tend to lean towards this being the more general bound, just because if you look at the rigorous statements, that term is always there. And typically, the strategy that you're going to go with is you're going to guess some big T runtimes. So choose some time parameter T, hope that that is enough time doing this interpolation, and then, you know, run, and at the end of the day, see what you get, and hope you solve it. There are other strategies that exist, and obviously people are very interested in other strategies, including me, but a lot of them have the drawback that they lack rigor, and where they don't lack rigor, they're based on a lot of heuristics, or other assumptions that we can't necessarily satisfy. Okay, well, let's look at one of the cases where we do know what's going on pretty precisely, which is adiabatic Grover search. If you know anything about regular quantum computing Grover search, you get O root V scaling. So if you have V vertices, you're looking for one of them that's marked. The runtime that's going to take you to do this with a quantum computer using Grover search is order root V. You can do this adiabatically as well using this particular driving Hamiltonian. This is equivalent to this is equivalent to the graph Laplacian for a complete graph. I'm not going to dig too much into that, but it's actually important to how we analyze all of these things. And W is going to be some diagonal potential, which in this case is going to be 0 and then a bunch of 1s. All right, so I'm not looking at the case where there's more than 1 0. 0 here represents a marked state. That's what we're looking for. Everything else is just something else. And so the best strategy we've got is here we've got the two lowest eigenvalues. Here's the gap minimum. And so basically what we want to do is we want to like not spend too much physical time until we hit the gap minimum, then spend a lot of physical time, then no more do we want to spend like a lot of physical time. And that's more or less the intuition of how you get through the gap minimum. This is great, but what happens once we don't know W anymore? Well, one reason you might care about this is like, suppose you have a SAT instance, right? Then the expected value of W is just going to be some energy, how many clauses you violate, or something like that. And it's not necessarily going to be either 0 or 1. And maybe also you can implement the Hamiltonian, but I know you've got to have some perturbation in order to do it for whatever reason, or I don't know, maybe you think you could pre-process your SAT instance, but it's going to be really expensive to do it. And so you're going to lose whatever advantage you would have just by going through and checking and make all your violating assignments into one. So again, the standard approach is just going to be to guess a runtime and go. But then again, the rigorous bounds are still going to say, well, we got to get some time that's going to scale like 1 over gap squared or 1 over gap cubed before we can really guarantee convergence out of the adiabatic theorem. So then some suggest some heuristic methods or whatever for better scaling. And, you know, there's a lot of that out there. But again, these are not always good enough for certainty. We've got a lot of numerical evidence that sometimes they'll work out, but at least in the current work, we want to make sure that at the end of the day, we get the best scaling possible and sort of a guarantee that we solved our problem. Okay. So just to see how bad things can get out of Grover and Grover-like things, this is just the Grover potential itself rescaled by a certain constant. And you can see the gap minimum shifts dramatically based on that constant. As it turns out, in order to get the right schedule, you've got to know pretty much to exponential accuracy where the gap minimum occurs. We have rigorous lower bounds on what the gap minimum is, but we need to know where it is. And so that's these first three things here. And the fourth one, that's just a random problem. So if you wanted to try and approximate a random problem with Grover search, you're not going to be able to do it. With Grover's potential. It starts out as one, becomes some other near its minimum, and then ends up at some other third thing. Okay. So that's also not going to be useful strategy. In fact, we tried doing that at some points and found out it does not work very well at all. So what do we do? One thing people want to do or want to try is we stick another Hamiltonian in the middle. This is going to make the gap larger, potentially. We don't know what that Hamiltonian is, but we just shove it in there, try making the gap bigger, and again, hope for the best. I don't really have much to say about that other than this is still like really a heuristic thing, except for in the cases where you can prove something. But if you look back at the picture, the same strategy is like you're not going to move this gap up reliably for every single one of the problems you're going to be interested in. Right, you might bump it up, you might introduce some other stuff, but it's not gonna be a reliable change. You're not gonna know exactly what you did. Okay, so the setup that I wanna consider is you have a fixed driving Hamiltonian, H-naught, that you can prepare. Somebody hands me a cost function, which we're gonna treat as an oracle. And then the final constraint is that I'm gonna produce the best schedule possible and whatever the result of that schedule is. So the idea is I want to do the best thing I can. I want to find out what the best schedule is that I could use, and I want to produce its result, and I want to do it as efficiently as possible. Okay, so there's two questions that seem important here. The first is, suppose you give me an oracle capable of returning the gap within some constant factor or whatever. How many queries to this oracle am I going to need before I'm able to actually determine a good annealing schedule, so how I'm gonna change my physical time. And then second, assuming that works out well, can we build the damn thing, right? The query complexity is nice, but we'd also like to be able to implement this. Okay, so we'll look at the first question first and then go on to the second. The second is going to be a little more technically challenging, so best to leave it. Okay, so we'll need a few tools, some mild adaptations of the adiabatic theorem, Weyl's inequalities, which are going to be very important to us, and then spectral graph theory, and this is the one where you should all just kind of pick up and leave or fall asleep or whatever it is that you do at that point in time. But these two are pretty straightforward. So the adiabatic theorem, there it is. That's a version of the adiabatic theorem due to Janssen, Ruskai, and Seidler? Anyway, I think I got that right. In 2006. Okay, you can see why you get either gap squared or gap cube scaling. But suppose we always satisfy that h dot is within some constant factor of the gap. So the change in the Hamiltonian is always going to be within some constant factor of the gap itself at that point, and also that it's linear. you're going to tell me that you shouldn't be able to satisfy this for all Hamiltonians, and I'm going to tell you, yeah, you're right, but we're going to do it anyway. And so then you get this. So this is a much nicer, this is a happier expression, right? Now you've got your big T time scaling like inverse cat. So if you can satisfy this, these constraints, then you know that, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't even tell you what the P's were. These P's are the projector onto the ground state and the projector onto the state produced by the actual physical process at time S. Yep.
So the dot means derivative with respect to S.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I sort of copied notation from JRS, and that's how they use dot. Normally, you're right, you would think of dot with respect to actual physical time. In this case, it's with respect to S. And also, thank you. If you do have questions, interrupt me while I'm going. It'll be easier.
So that's the error?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
So that's the error.
That's right. Yeah. So if you scale T up like inverse gap, you can arbitrarily reduce your error. Okay. You know, we want to satisfy this stuff all the time, so how do we do it? Well, this is where we turn to Weyl's inequalities. They're a perturbative inequality about... next slide, this slide.
Yeah, this one. I mean, you sort of commented very briefly on this what if. Are you gonna explain more?
Well, yes, I am. So what if, you should all be saying, well, yeah, that's a great what if, but it's not something we're gonna be able to do in general. And the whole point of this talk is that I'm going to give you a way to do it in general. At the end of the day. But like the next tool along the process is going to be Weyl's inequality. Okay, so here's Weyl's inequality. It's just a perturbative inequality in the eigenvalues. So if you look at eigenvalue I of h plus delta and subtract from it eigenvalue I of just h, delta here is the perturbation. The change in the eigenvalue is at most the norm of the perturbation. This should be reasonably obvious even without it having Weyl's name attached to it, but that's an inequality. And it's actually a bit tighter than that, but for our purposes, this is all we want to use because this is the best guarantee that we're going to be given when we're performing the algorithm. And so we're going to convert this into a gap inequality. So basically, if the ground state can only go up by delta and the first excited state can only go down by delta, then the gap can only close by 2 delta, okay? And so if HS is linear, then this just becomes this guy right here, okay?
So in the first inequality, the I indicates like...
The ith eigenvalue. Yeah, so lambda 0, I always use lambda 0 for the ground state. Lambda v minus 1, because we're on a thing with v vertices, would be the highest eigenvector, eigenvalue. Okay, and so basically it gives you this inequality. So you've got some 4 delta s times the norm of h. Okay, how do we use this? Well, this is what I call the bashful adiabatic algorithm. The idea is really simple. Suppose we have access to this oracle, which I'm calling get gap here. And this is kind of a cartoon version of the algorithm. If you ask me for my paper, it's a little bit more detailed than this, but this is the idea. You initialize your state to the initial gap. Right, we assume we know that because our experimentalist built some Hamiltonian in the lab, the driving Hamiltonian, so we can just assume we know everything about it a priori. And then until we hit S is less than 1, we're going to take steps of size delta S equal to some constant that's less than 1 times the gap at that point divided by 4. And why divided by 4? Well, if you put that in here, it basically guarantees you that the upper bound here is on the order of the gap itself. I'm assuming my Hamiltonian is normalized, so its norm is 1. Does that step why this step keeps you within C naught of the gap make sense? Because that's kind of important.
I mean, so this is in the goal is to get this what if condition to be satisfied.
That's right.
But isn't that a condition on the path?
So right now we're choosing just a perturbation and we're kind of just assuming the linear interpolation between one point and the next. So we're always doing linear interpolations. So if you look here, this last thing is HS being linear. So we can have two points, like the initial point can be H of SI, and we want to get to H of SI plus one. And we're going to implement it using something. I'm using sigma here as a new time parameter. And delta S is just going to be the difference between SI plus one and SI. Now, because it's linear, H dot is well known. It's the same no matter what, just scaled by a factor of delta S.
You're constructing a discretized path that satisfies this what-if condition as we go.
That's right, as we go. But we're never taking a step beyond when we know we satisfy the discretized path. We satisfy this condition. So we satisfy that condition. We update S to the to what we just found. We add this to our array in the schedule, and we keep looping until we get to the end, until S is equal to 1. All right, so let's just see how this looks. It's probably easier with a cartoon. We know this point initially, right? This is our initial gap, and we just know that because we built it. Viles inequality says that for all times in that blue shaded region, basically the gap falls within that blue shaded region, and the black line here is a strict lower bound on the gap. Cannot get smaller. So we sample at the very end. It gives us that point. Okay, that's what getGap returned us. For the cartoon, we're assuming that getGap is perfect. We're not doing any of the stuff we're going to be doing later where it's not perfect. Okay, so now we do the same thing for the next region. Sample, once again, we get back. It's kind of adhering to the lower bound right now. One more time, you get the idea. We keep going. Eventually, we get down here. You see the points are getting closer and closer together as the gap gets smaller. So we're naturally slowing down with respect to the size of the gap. We're taking more and more samples, okay? And our blue region's also getting smaller because we're only considering smaller and smaller steps. You also notice that we're no longer adhering to the lower bound of the blue shaded region. Okay, so we keep going, and now while we sketched out this really nasty thing because we're always just keeping track of the lower bound, not other bounds, but we just keep going and we get all the way to the end this way, okay? And we could have been smart and we could have applied Viles inequalities in reverse the whole time to smooth out our schedule, and this is what we would have gotten. And if I remove the dots, this is basically our lower bound on the gap now. That's pretty spot on to what you want it to be, okay? So this is what if I'm allowed to query the gap. Now the next question you should ask, does anyone have the next question? Does anyone know what it should be? Okay, the next question should be, well, how many queries do you need to this function getGap? Because if you can't even implement this efficiently in terms of number of queries to this function, well, it doesn't matter whether or not this function exists. And I don't know why I put this next. I'll come back to that slide. I think at the time I thought that would be better to show you right then, but after seeing it up on the screen, I changed my mind. How many calls do we need? Well, so let's assume that getGap obeys this condition. What is this condition saying? I would conjecture that this is actually always obeyed near a gap minimum. And what is all it's saying is that this is some sort of constraint that the width of your gap minimum should be proportional to your distance from it. All right, this is not necessarily the best way to state it, but this is sort of a way to state it, and it's sufficient for the current results. I don't think anybody should really object to that too much. You might. I'm pretty sure for these linear sort of situations, this is going to more or less be satisfied, and you can prove it's satisfied. If that's true, then we're going to require at most this many calls. And I'll show you why on the next slide. And we know that we're going to get back some function getGap that's always within some reasonable approximation of the gap the entire time. Yeah.
For the Janssen Ruskaya Seiler, don't you need the schedule to be like differentiable?
Ah, I didn't show how to do this, but I triangle inequality that way. You could also, if you also notice that you're only taking logarithmically many points, the set over which you're removing the, it's a set of measure zero that you're removing the discontinuities are on. So you could go back to their proof and redo it, taking these discontinuities out. But the answer to your question is in that algorithm I skipped over, which I'll show you in a second. But I just want to show you the number of queries first. Okay, so to see that we get the right number of queries, all you do is you basically say, this is the recurrence relation, what do you call it, satisfied by this algorithm. You drop in this constraint that I just mentioned on the last slide, and then you solve the recurrence and it gives you this. And you can see in I, you converge exponentially quickly to something bigger than the minimum, the gap where the minimum gap is. And this is on one side, and then you can do something similar for the other side. And so you get that it's going to take you a logarithmic number of steps to get to and past the gap minimum, just based on the fact that you're satisfying this particular occurrence. So now, for David's question, we're going to stick that into this for generating the adiabatic state. And so what your question about is really this steps 9 through 16 of the loop, which is where basically all we're doing is we're choosing an appropriate timescale, appropriate error, such that we have sketched it out based on that schedule I just showed you. And then we're just taking the output of one and shoving it in as the input of the next, and we're just going to accumulate our errors. So, I mean, you can think of just applying the adiabatic theorem, just whatever error you started with, saying, okay, that's error, I'm just going to accept it, and whatever, like, my overlap with the actual ground state is, let's just apply the adiabatic theorem to that. Now, you could derive you could almost certainly derive a better statement than this, and I think some people have. It was just beyond the scope of what I wanted to do here. Okay. All right, so this gives you logarithmic number of queries in this function getGap. So this oracle for the gap. Yep, so, okay, great. The gap's known to be a hard thing to understand. Can we actually do this? Well, you're gonna need some more math. And so this is actually where spectral graph theory, as far as I can tell, is the only existing way to really analyze this. There may be other ways to analyze it. I don't know of any. Okay, that means I have to introduce some definitions and some inequalities. So first, here's a Hamiltonian. It's gonna have some Laplacian L and some W, which is just a diagonal whatever matrix, doesn't matter what's in it, then what you, this should not be parameterized by S because H, well, I guess it can be, but H is static. then basically this inequality applies. And so before I tell you what H is, the important thing to note is that H is both an upper and a lower bound on the gap. So if you can discover H, which is potentially much easier to understand than the gap itself, then you have an upper and a lower bound on your gap at all times. Okay? And H is this nasty expression right here. It's called the weighted Cheeger constant of the graph. And so what phi is, I'll explain what this means on the next slide. And so basically, you can prove similar inequalities I did in another paper that basically show that for more general Hermitian L and W, you can still get expressions that look almost exactly like this, provided you satisfy certain constraints. So here's H, here's a picture of what it means, and here's also why you should believe that this is going to make a very good oracle for the gap, if such a thing exists. So first, let's just look at the denominator. That's the easier of the two terms to understand. In the denominator, we're just going to take our state space, and we're going to divide it into two sets of states, S and S bar. I don't care what S and S bar are, we're just going to divide up our states that way. We're going to measure things in the computational basis, and we're going to calculate the probability that we were found in S, and we're going to, you know, also therefore calculate the probability of being in S bar. the minimum of those two, that's our denominator. So this is fundamentally measurable in the computational basis, just using projective measurements in the computational basis. Numerator is a little bit harder. Here you've got the amplitude of a vertex u on this side times the amplitude of some vertex v on this side that it's connected to. And you have to sum up over all these. But this is just some matrix that's going to look like 0, some 1s, 0. And we're going to take the expected value of that under our ground state phi. And so the idea is this is also in principle something where maybe you can't build that many of them because we're no longer in the computational basis, but you should be able to measure at least some subset of these things in the not computational basis, provided you can build some of them. Right? So it looks like this thing's fundamentally, at least in principle, measurable. If it's not, that's Antonio's fault. So, all right. What restrictions do we want to impose, and what problem do we want to consider? Well, the problem we want to consider is we're given a cost function, it has some minimum, the minimum zero. If it's not, I mean, we could turn this into a decision question just as well, but I'm not going to. The ratio of the largest eigenvalue, or rather, the largest element of the cost function to the smallest element of the cost function is bounded by some constant. And that's really just saying that if you start with a problem, W mapping 0 to 1, W mapping V to 0, 1, the range of things we're trying never gets exponentially close to 0, right? It's just saying that stuff is, the gap is finite. They're basically the same constraint. Okay, so we've got some cost function with a finite gap. We don't want to handle the case where the gap is not finite. Because if the gap's not finite, well, then our minimum gap could occur at the end of the interpolation, and that would require all sorts of different analysis. Also, it would require dealing with the fact that there could be multiple marked vertices and stuff that is beyond the scope of what I'm doing here.
So what does finite mean? Does it mean independent of problem size? Or?
Yeah, right. It's just something that doesn't scale down as the problem size gets larger. So you don't want like a gap that shrinks in the cost function. I don't care about the driving Hamiltonian, but in the cost function, you don't want the gap shrinking exponentially as the problem scales up.
So this does not hold for spin glasses, right? The smallest and largest eigenvalues, I believe, scale badly, right, with size.
I'm not 100% sure, but
for a nice Hamiltonian with enough disorder and enough connectivity, I think that scales badly with
it's
size.
It's possible. I mean, I'm not 100% sure. I'd need to, like, I'd really need to give it some thought. I mean, for most optimization problems, this is pretty general, but if you relax this constraint, you're basically telling me that you have an exponentially small gap at the very end, and it's potentially smaller than the actual like gap anywhere else in the interpolation. I mean, that's really the reason I'm imposing this constraint, and I could relax it a bit to say that the gap has got to be bigger than like 2 root v, 2 square root, which is, in the normalized setting, 1 over 2 root v. But without some sort of small promise like that, you're not going to be able to push these theorems through.
Oh, wait a second. Sorry, actually, there's a gap at the end, right? So that is something else than what I have.
Oh, yeah, this is not the gap in the middle of the Hamiltonian or middle of any interpolation. This is just at the end.
Okay, all right. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think these constraints are fairly general. I don't believe that like I'm imposing anything that anybody would really object to. The one you should maybe object to is this first one here, and I'm working on getting rid of that one right now.
Is M?
Just some vertex. I'm using M for marked. It's just the cost of some particular vertex is zero.
Subtract off whatever that constant is?
Well, not using the oracle that I'm about to construct. Because, well, you'll see. So right now I'm trying to build an oracle, and I do believe that you can do something like you just said, but it's going to take more machinery than I'm prepared to put out there right now. Okay. And we already saw that all information is contained in the ground state, and that's why I believe this quantity to be fundamentally measurable. But in this case, this right-hand side can get quadratically weak, right? Because the degree of the graph is going to scale potentially with the size of the graph. And that's just, H can be of order V, D can, sorry, H can be of order root V, D can be of order V, and so the you're gonna get a quadratically weak bound there. So we gotta make something tighter for this case, and this also indicates that if you wanna do this, the inequalities you're going to derive are going to depend upon your driving Hamiltonian. So you probably can't just start with an arbitrary driving Hamiltonian and expect any set of inequalities to be the best ones to use. If you've got a, no matter what, a bounded degree here, then you probably don't care. If the degree is not scaling with your driving Hamiltonian, but otherwise you're probably gonna care. So here's how we tighten it up, and I just put this here to scare you. But the key point is that this Cheeger constant HM, this is actually a Cheeger ratio because it's not the constant defined previously, is bigger than this guy over here, and we actually satisfy this inequality where kappa is the upper bound on the spectral ratio. So now HM for this particular M, where M is the Mark state, gives you both upper and lower bounds on the gap within a constant factor. So if you can determine HM, you now know what your gap is within some sort of constant upper and lower bound. Okay, and that's really what we need to apply this adiabatic algorithm that I described earlier. And here's just some comparisons of the bounds so you can see. This is 2H. This red line here is what you get out of H and H over kappa. It only becomes kappa after the H over kappa after the gap minimum. And then this blue line is the actual spectral gap. So you can see that it initially starts out as the lower bound. It actually is close to the upper bound near the gap minimum. And eventually it goes back somewhere in between the two. Why this is important is basically if you're not tight to the upper bound near the minimum, you're gonna be in trouble. Bottom line here is that linear sort of envelope I was describing before that is the condition that needs to be satisfied by get gap in order to guarantee a logarithmic number of queries. This is a very small problem size just to generate a cartoon in general. Like these, all of these would be way tighter and higher up. But it's much easier to see what's going on. Okay. So, all right, now the next question is, okay, so we've got this upper and lower bound. Next question is, can we learn it? The answer is yes, we can, with some restrictions. Your eigenvectors always satisfy this. And so when you plug in M, the Mark state, we know that the potential of the Mark state is zero, just by the way we set up the problem. And so that means we get this particular relationship, which gives us this relationship, which gives us this guy over here. So you see that unlike necessarily the first excited state, or I'm sorry, the spectral gap itself, H is exactly inversely proportional with the ground state energy. When we're restricted to this complete graph case.
Is it V?
What is what?
V?
V is the number of vertices. Sorry. So this is just what one satisfies. And this is when phi m is less than or equal to 1 over root 2. The expressions get more complicated but still tractable when it's not. But once you hit phi m equal a half, well, equal 1 over root 2, maybe you don't care anymore anyway.
Sorry, this equation at the bottom, this hm quantity is basically the number of vertices minus the ground state energy?
Hm is the degree minus the ground state energy, basically. V minus 1 is the degree.
And then you said that the gap is related to HM.
Yeah, the gap's going to be bigger than HM.
Sorry, the number of vertices is like 2 to the n or something, right?
Yep.
So the left-hand side should be like a in, you know, some large, it would be like a large number.
Mm-hmm.
But the gap is not bigger than that, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't think I follow your question.
So the gap is bigger than H?
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. So right now we're, the Hamiltonian I presented you with here is not normalized. So its scale is on the scale of V. So basically, this here, you would need to divide by V to get the actual, what you expect out of the gap of the real system. And in fact, you'd also need to multiply it by 1 minus S, where S is the time in the interpolation. But right now, we're just looking at how to get a hold of this constant itself. So all of that kind of goes away, since it just depends on the eigenvectors satisfying the equation.
So for good research, what do we actually get for the gap?
I'm sorry, I missed.
For good research, what do we get for the gap out of the last equation here after all the renormalization and everything is done?
If we're actually doing Grove research,
yeah.
It's going to be like 1 over root V. Maybe 1 over 2 root V. You might be short the factor of 2. But if you're actually doing Grove, you're within a constant of the actual gap after you normalize things appropriately. If you're not doing Grove research, if you have this spectral ratio kappa getting very big, you're going to get a much weaker statement. But if you don't expect kappa to scale with V, it doesn't matter for our asymptotic analysis. Okay. We also have this, and this is kind of just magical. The eigenvector equation that we saw on the previous page satisfied this. So we just do some manipulations. We divide out the parenthetical term, sum over both sides, kill off the one norms, and you're left with basically hm plus 1 being the root of this equation. 1 equals that stuff. So all we're really going to do is we're going to take a bunch of computational basis samples of the cost function, just, you know, guess a bunch of computational basis states, measure their energy, and then apply some statistical inequalities to generate an oracle that's going to give us, well, we can just use a classical root finding method to then solve that equation. Okay? And so that's going to be the approach to creating an oracle. And so basically what this gives us is that with probability 1 minus p, we can create get gap with at most v to the 2/3 queries to w using some root finding function that gives us within some small constant of the actual value of hm, and where hm is bigger than v to the 2/3. This actually can be improved drastically if kappa is very small. So if you give me kappa being 1, that is the spectral ratio is 1, you're actually doing some Grover type problem, you can do this in one shot, right? You don't need to take v to the 2/3 samples, and you can get all the way down to hm being order root v. But there's some balancing here between what your spectral ratio is and how much you can demand out of Hefting's inequality, or the algorithm in general. Okay, so now here's the oracle. This is kind of there's way more to it. The entire actual oracle takes up a page. It wouldn't fit on a slide, but this is the main routine. You give it some S, some delta S, some gap, and some constant C. You just extract from the previous estimate of the gap. You're going to get an update for that's what H used to be, right? That's your assumption about what H used to be if you've been following this routine the whole time. If S is 0, you actually know what H is supposed to be, so you're just going to override that. Also, you wouldn't have any input, so maybe I should have done something with S not being 0 here, but I guess it doesn't really matter. We're going to use this classical root finding method to determine H. And then if H is 0, that means the root finding method now fails. We know we're now exponentially close to our minimum gap. So we're like right about there. And so we're just going to follow this linear envelope that I described earlier, that like get gap is supposed to obey. And you can analytically prove that any one of these guys does, any member of this class of cost functions will give you this sort of linear envelope that I described. Right? And then you just follow it. And so that gets you all the way down here. You discover where the minimum gap is. You go pretty slowly through the minimum gap, and then you just obey some increasing thing where you know the entire time you're below the actual gap. So you know you always have a lower bound on the estimate of the gap itself. Look like I may have lost some people. All right, well, so this is just a statement of some results. If kappa is that spectral ratio I mentioned, this is the bound that you're going, it can introduce at most this many queries. You might need to evaluate this every time you query too, so you might need to multiply that by the logarithm, the number of queries you need to get through things. the total queries to get gap by BAA is then at most this. Oh, I'm sorry, the v to the 1/6. The reason for v to the 1/6 is because we can only get down to where h is order v to the 2/3. Once we're at h being order v to the 2/3, we need to get down to root v. So we're just gonna use a lower bound for a while, and then we know we eventually get through it in a certain fixed number of steps, but it's gonna be of order v to the 1/6. So we can, depending on what kappa is, introduce some number of extra steps beyond what our query complexity suggests, and that's just based on the fact that our oracle's not perfect. So then the total queries can scale like this. This is the from the query complexity to get gap from the previous assumptions, and then the extra steps we've added in by using this less than perfect schedule. The total samples to build the oracle is then gonna be at most something like this, right? Because this is just what we described using Hefting's inequality. The total runtime then of the full adiabatic process is, this should have a closed parenthesis here, is 1 over gap min times a logarithm in 1 over gap min plus this kappa minus 1 to the thirds v to the 1/6 over gap min epsilon, and it just basically gives you this guy over here. So if kappa is really close to 1, you recover Grover scaling. If kappa is not really close to 1, then you've got a bit more work to do. The total runtime is then this nasty expression. Again, the only reason for keeping around the root v is because when kappa is really close to 1, the second term can disappear. And it gives you something back with exponentially, like it gives you the right state with exponentially high probability. And that's just because you're choosing terms to match other terms and having your query complexity work out the way it does. Sorry, not query complexity, having your time complexity work out appropriately. Now suppose you want to get this to be optimal. Well, what you do is the naive thing. You start by guessing kappa actually equals 1. And then you guess kappa equals 1 plus epsilon, and kappa equals whatever, all the way up until kappa equals 2. Once kappa equals 2, then you just say, well, kappa's got to be less than 1 over the gap of the final of the problem Hamiltonian, and I go with it. And this is going to basically, if you do the right number of repetitions, give you an expected runtime that is the best that this algorithm can produce, right? So your expected runtime is going to be whatever the runtime would be had you guessed kappa properly if you use this procedure. Okay, so lessons we've learned, and I titled it in case people have not been paying attention or fell asleep or got lost. So it's not likely that we're gonna be able to use these heuristics or the schedules to get reliable results, but we can get an advantage, a genuine advantage on a large class of problems. And we don't need very much information to do it. We just need a couple upper bounds. The quantum adiabatic optimization algorithm is for a special purpose, so we should design our hardware such that measuring this H is actually an easy thing to do, right? In this case, it was super easy. We had the complete graph, and so measuring H could be done basically classically. You step away from the complete graph, you might need more, you might need some quantum samples, some quantum measurements, but if you have a nice, like some nice algebraic properties, you can probably get by with like logarithmically many different guesses at what your cuts are supposed to be before you get a reasonable approximation of what the Cheeger constant actually should be. Room for improvement, our oracle can be improved. So there's very much room for improvement, but you're probably not gonna get any asymptotic advantage out of doing that. You're probably just gonna shave off some constants, maybe change what kappa is or the dependence upon kappa. You can get rid of kappa and consider some actual probability distributions. You can probably therefore speed that up, but you know, you're not going to get too much there. Generalization of multiple mark states should be easy. I put easy in scare quotes because I haven't done it and I don't know how that would work out. It doesn't seem like a terribly hard problem to me. The Cheeger inequalities still basically apply once you project into the appropriate subspace. So you could just derive Cheeger inequalities for the appropriate subspace, guess the number of mark states, start with half your states being marked, divide by two until you get all the way down to one, and just use the appropriate schedule. Exit as soon as you find something that you like. Generalizing to other graphs, this is obviously the most important thing, right? The complete graph, it presents both the simplest and the hardest case. It's the hardest because the gap definitely gets exponentially small. It's the simplest because the math becomes easiest and most tractable, which is why I guess we played with it for this work. And we'd like to remove this restriction on on the min of WM. And I'm talking to Antonio about how to do that. I think it's going to require X basis measurements, though. I don't know that I can do this and keep everything computational basis and stochastic. All right. I mean, it would be great if I could. I can't come up with a way to do it just yet. Again, it looks like this is doable with O log. These are just some preliminary results. It looks like we can do this with something on the order of log V many measurements. We'll be able to implement this and get rid of this restriction. I guess some other ideas, you might be able to use this in Monte Carlo simulations of some condensed matter systems and stuff like that, because this is going to give you a set of points where you should sample as you move around your state space, and you know nothing changes very much around the point you're currently at. So you know how far you can move, how far you can safely move away without greatly affecting, more or less, without greatly affecting the ground state itself. But those are just, you know, a sketch of some other ideas, and that's about it. I mean, maybe like this could be applied to classical SAT solving. I don't know. That's always a good target. And that's all I got. So, questions? Well, I guess if no question, or yeah.
So like the results you presented were for a Hamiltonian where you have a Laplacian of a complete graph plus a diagonal piece.
That's right.
So, but did I understand correctly that for other graphs, the challenge is computing this Cheeger?
That's right. And I think that that's actually, as I said, I think that this is doable. And the reason I think it's doable is because you really only need the basis of the initial Hamiltonian and the final Hamiltonian in order to, or you probably only need the bases of the initial Hamiltonian and the final Hamiltonian in order to compute these things, just because the numerator is basically related to your transition amplitudes. The denominator is related to your probability of being found in either of the two subsets. Obviously, the denominator is very easy to compute. You just measure in the computational basis. You get back a number.
A maximization and a minimization.
That's right. So you do this a bunch of times, and you just take so you choose a bunch of sets, S, each one of a different size or something like that. You sample what HS is in each set, you take its minimum, so you randomize like which bit strings, for instance, fall in that set. You take the minimum over the things you've seen. You take the maximum over all the different sets you've tried. And then usually, at least in the classical setting, that works out to give you something that's reasonably close to the actual Cheeger constant. So you can know analytically that with high probability, you're within some certain bound of what the Cheeger constant actually should be. Now, if you know the main condition that needs to be satisfied, that's kind of hard-ish maybe to show, is this guy right here, right? That's maybe hard to show, but you only really need this thing to be tight at the gap minimum. And so if you know that even this simple inequality here is tight near the minimum, then you're pretty good. And actually the problem with, so one way I thought we could speed this up, well, I still think we can speed this up, it's just not worth the overhead of actually writing it up as an example, is once you hit close to the gap minimum, you start sampling in the computational basis and collecting probabilities. And then you can use that to update your schedule if you really are interested in preparing the full state. I mean, once you really are going to solve your optimization problem before you even get to the gap minimum. The hard part of the computation is like just before the phase transition, not during it. I don't know why, but that's just, I mean, I kind of have an intuitive idea why, but it's not. It's basically when one amplitude, at least in the complete graph case, when you have one amplitude that's exponentially larger than all of the others, but still not large enough to reliably observe, is when that's when you have trouble. And I think that's actually when you're always gonna have trouble in these sorts of things. So if these oracles are gonna go bad, it's probably gonna be in those situations.
Okay, so let's thank Michael again.